left wrist, left hand to right wrist. Suddenly, Andy was more aware of her own racing heartbeat than his. "Now just relax," he said. She took a deep breath. It was okay that she was shaking. Kira would be shaking. "Do I frighten you, Kira?"
"Yes."
"Why?"
"I don't know."
"Are you afraid of what I might ask you?"
"No."
His grip tightened around her pulse. "You're lying."
"I'm just nervous."
"How old are you, Kira?"
27.
"Where were you born?"
"Seattle."
"Tell me about your parents."
"What do you want to know?"
"Everything." Andy concentrated. It was crucial to recite her phony background accurately. Should Bleckman check, she wanted to make sure she checked out.
"My mother taught high school for over 30 years. She's retired now. My dad worked at Boeing most of his life, till he died 6 years ago."
"What kind of relationship do you have with your mother?"
"Normal."
"Do you have your own apartment?"
"No."
"You think it's normal for a 27-year-old woman to live with her mother?"
"So long as you're a little embarrassed by it, I guess it is."
He didn't crack a smile. "Where does your mother live?"
"Tacoma."
He asked a series of questions about her mother's background and lifestyle. It would all check out. The FBI had enlisted a retired agent to pose as Kira's mother. "Do you love her?"
"Yes, of course."
"Did you love your father?"
"Yes."
"Have you ever loved anyone outside your immediate family?" They were outside the phony FBI background now. Andy thought of her ex-fiancé.
"I would say no."
He smirked.
"I would say yes."
Andy flinched. Bleckman bore down. "You've recently ended a relationship, haven't you?"
"I've never been married, if that's what you mean."
"A broken engagement?" She squirmed, amazed he had figured that out. Bleckman said, "You don't want to talk about it, do you?"
"There's not much to talk about."
"Let's go back where you feel safe, then. Do you have any brothers or sisters?" She hesitated for an instant. Again, the real world was closing in around her. Truthfully, she didn't know. She gave the FBI's answer.
"No."
"Are you sure?"
"Of course I'm sure. I would know if I had brothers or sisters."
"Were you adopted, Kira?" The insight floored her. He continued. "Do you sometimes wonder about your real parents?"
"I don't know what you mean."
His stare tightened. "The green eyes are a nice cover."
"They're not a cover, they're mine."
"How does an Indian girl get green eyes?"
"What?
You're part Indian, aren't you? I can see it." Not everyone could, not even some Native Americans. But if he was onto it, there was no sense denying it.
"Part, yes."
"Which part? Body or spirit?"
"I don't know how to answer that."
"What tribe are your ancestors from?"
"I don't know."
"You were adopted, weren't you?" She suddenly regretted the "I don't know." She should have just picked Cherokee or some other tribe that didn't have good record keeping, one that Bleckman could never have verified. Not knowing your tribe was a red flag for adoption.
"Yes, I was adopted."
He seemed to smile faintly, confident he was getting somewhere. "If I were to guess, I would say you're Yakima."
"Why?"
"The word Yakima means runaway. Are you a runaway?"
"No."
"You're running from something, Kira. Tell me what it is."
"I really don't know what you mean."
"Are you running from something you've hidden in your past? Or are you running from the fact that you don't know your past?"
"The past is just the past."
"No, Kira. Until you've transcended the human level, you are defined by the past. It's who you are." He looked deeply into her eyes.
Who are you, Kira?
What do you mean?
You are not who you say you are. Tell me who you are, who you really are. Her fear soared to another level. Either he knew she was a phony, or he was on the verge of figuring it out. She broke from his grip and sprang from her chair, ready to run for her life. Stop! He shouted. Andy wheeled, ready to defend herself. It's okay, said Bleckman. Part of her said run, but she fought the impulse. Her cover wasn't completely blown yet. At least she didn't think so. His voice and demeanor were unthreatening. Kira, many of my most devoted followers lied to me at first about their pasts. Some were simply unable to talk freely about past abusive relationships. Others were afraid I would reject them if they revealed their previous life of crime, drug abuse, sexual promiscuity, or whatever. She felt a wave of relief. He didn't even suspect she was FBI. Just another loner with a checkered past.
I'm sorry I lied to you.
I'm sorry I made you uncomfortable. But to come on this journey, you have to break with the past. To break with the past, you have to confront your demons.
That's what I want to do.
Good. And don't be afraid. You won't go through this alone. Felicia will help you. I will help you. And as you progress from one level to the next, you will find others to help you overcome the human traits that torment you.
I'm not really tormented by anything.
Yes, you are. That's why you're here. Only when you rid yourself of those past vibrations can you vibrate at the next level. Do you want to reach the next level?
Yes, of course.
Then make that your sole objective for all your remaining days on this planet. Not to become a better human, as your parents and teachers instructed you, but to become more than human. As long as you are human, it makes no difference whether you're a prostitute or a scientist, a minister or a murderer. She cringed inside of the mention of a murderer.
I understand.
He rose and stepped toward her. Andy took a half step back, but she was suddenly in his grasp. She stiffened with fear, but it was just a warm embrace. He held her for nearly a full minute, then whispered softly, "Your name is now Willow, and you belong to us." Chapter 56. Gus had his investigator tail him to the meeting with Meredith Borge, fully armed, just in case. Though it would be illegal to record their conversation without Meredith's consent, Dex wired him up anyway. No telling what direction this might take, he wanted it all on tape. The coffee shop was nearly empty, just two men at opposite ends of the counter, and a family of five sucking down the spaghetti special at a corner table. Meredith was alone in a booth by the revolving pie display. Gus arrived precisely at 8 o'clock, as instructed.
"Got your call," he said.
She looked up from her coffee and gave a sideways glance toward the door, as if checking to make sure he hadn't been followed.
"Have a seat."
The waitress poured him a cup and freshened Meredith's. After she'd gone, Gus asked, "Why the change of heart?
Why were you so stupid as to come to my front door in broad daylight?"
Gus wasn't sure how to respond, but after the message on his windshield this afternoon, it was a fairly astute question.
"Guess I wasn't thinking. That's a dangerous way to live.
I'm no stranger to danger, at least not lately. I know all about your situation." He wondered if that included the alleged spouse abuse. "Don't believe everything you read in the papers or see on television."
"I don't. But my daughter was a very reliable source."
Gus stopped in mid-sip. "Shirley told me she didn't even know you were alive."
"We didn't talk for quite some time, that's true."
"You mean after she conspired to kill you?" His knowing surprised her.
"That put a crimp in the relationship, yeah."
"So when did you get over it?" When she called and told me you were going to pay her $250,000. If she could help me find my wife. Which is precisely the reason she called me. I don't follow you. She smiled wryly. No way Shirley was going to find her without my help. Do you know where my wife is?
No.
Stop playing games with me. It's not a game. It's a theory. Shirley's theory, to be exact. But she couldn't prove it without me. I know what you need to know. Gus was tiring of her coyness. Are you talking about the cult? My, you have done your homework. What do you know about it? You mean the one in the Yakima Valley, right? The one on 10 acres of land with the old white farmhouse, big barn, apple and apricot orchards? Chicken coop out back? Either you're totally making this up or you've been there. I lived there. When? Long before your wife started shoplifting and donating clothes to the Second Chance. Are you still involved? No, it's been years. Used to be a very positive environment. I got out when Bleckman took over. Bleckman? Younger guy, very ambitious. Likes to think he pioneered the cult's thinking. But he's just another egomaniac with a pulpit. How do you mean? He wrote this manuscript he thought was going to sell 50 million copies and spend 2 years on the New York Times bestseller list. Over 1,000 pages. I'm sure it's been rejected by every publisher on the planet. Not that there isn't a market for this secular evangelism stuff. You've seen all these books lately that tap into the wave of spiritualism and enlightenment without conventional religion. Anyway, Bleckman thought he could parlay the book into a weekly magazine, CD-ROMs, audio tapes, his own worldwide television talk show. So far, the only place the philosophy seems to have caught on is on his farm. What's the philosophy? Can't say. Never read the book. I would think you would have gained some insights just from being around the farm.
You would think, she said vaguely.
What's the book's title? His manuscript. There's no book. He calls it The Echoes. The Echoes? What does that mean? Maybe you should read it and find out. Can you get me a copy?
Sure. On sale. A mere fraction of what you offered Shirley. $25,000.
For a stinking, unpublished manuscript? You want to find your wife, or don't you? You're saying the book will tell me where Beth is? Her sly smile was back. I think it just might explain everything. Why should I believe that? Why do you think my daughter was murdered? Your daughter's death was suicide, not homicide. Then why didn't they find any step stool or chair or anything like that around her? How did she suspend herself from the ceiling all by herself?
I don't know anything about that.
You met Shirley. You really believe she hanged herself? Gus didn't answer, but the woman had a point. She leaned closer, elbows on the table, her voice low. This cult is like a fucking octopus. It's got arms that reach everywhere. Prisons, thrift shops, even perfect little neighborhoods like yours.
Gus met her stare. How soon can I get my hands on that manuscript?
Just as soon as you can get me the cash.
Tomorrow.
I'll call you, she said. Don't call me. Don't come by my house. And don't you dare tell anyone we talked. I don't want to end up like my daughter, understand?
Yeah, said Gus. I'm beginning to.
They left separately. First Meredith, then Gus, a few minutes later. Gus called his investigator from his car phone.
You heard?
Yeah, said Dex. His car was just a block away. The wire worked perfectly.
What do you think?
I think someone was watching you.
What?
I had my eye on the green Mercury across the street from the hotel. It sat there the whole time you and Meredith talked and then pulled away when you did. Could be FBI. Could be someone else.
Gus checked his rearview mirror.
pairs of headlights scattered across three lanes behind him, but in the dark it was impossible to tell if any belonged to a green Mercury.
You think they followed me here or Meredith?
Depends on who they are, and whether Meredith is still part of them.
Meaning she could still be part of the cult.
Think back to the last thing she said to you. I don't want to end up like my daughter. Interesting coincidence that she used almost the same language that was in the letter you got on your windshield.
Gus stopped at the traffic light.
I don't think she's with the cult anymore, Dex.
You heard her words over the wire, but only I could see the anger in her face. She hates this Bleckman, the way she ridiculed his writings, emphasizing it wasn't a book, just a crappy manuscript. If you ask me, she's even forgiven her daughter for conspiring to kill her. I think she blames the cult for that.
That's a lot of assumptions, said Dex.
I don't think it's an outrageous assumption, especially the part about Shirley's death being murder rather than suicide.
I'm with you there, said Dex.
Good, because if Shirley was killed, that might even explain that note on my windshield this afternoon.
How so?
It's in Beth's handwriting, so let's assume she wrote it. She warned that if I talk to Meredith Borge, she'll end up like Shirley. That makes no sense if Shirley committed suicide, but it makes total sense if Shirley was murdered.
I would agree with you if she had signed it in her own name, but she signed it as Flora. That sounds like a cult name to me.
That's my whole point. Someone in the cult forced Beth to write the letter. It's a warning to me in Beth's own handwriting that my wife will be killed if I talk to Meredith. It means they're holding Beth against her will.
Or it means that Beth is happy being Flora in her new life with the cult and wants you to back off. Because if her husband keeps snooping around, she's afraid they might decide she's more trouble than she's worth.
I like my theory better.
Don't be so sure, said Dex. If you're right, they'll kill her if they find out you're talking to Meredith.
The traffic light changed. Gus pulled onto the expressway ramp.
If I'm right, she's as good as dead if I don't talk to Meredith.
Chapter 57.
The old farmhouse was quiet by day, still as death at night. Occasionally a floorboard would creak in the hall outside the bedroom door. Water could sometimes be heard rushing through the old pipes in the wall. The furnace would kick on and rattle against the cold. For Beth Wheatley, those were the familiar sounds of the night. That and the VCR at midnight. She lay motionless beneath the blankets. The double bed was in the corner. Her back was to the door, her face to the wall in a windowless room. The television screen provided the only light. It would last just 20 minutes, as it had every night at the same time, for the past 2 weeks. This had become a silent nightly ritual, and tonight was no exception. The lock clicked and the door opened. The room brightened just a bit with light from the hallway. Beth didn't stir. The door closed and the room returned to darkness. Heavy boots pounded the wood floor, then halted. She felt watched, as though someone were standing over her. Her heart raced, but she didn't dare move. After a long minute, she could sense her visitor back slowly away from the bed and rest in the chair facing the television. As if on cue, it started. For nearly 20 minutes, Beth listened in the darkness, lying on her side, her back to the television and her nightly visitor. After 14 nights, she knew the tape by heart. Not the video, just the audio. She had forced herself never to steal a glance at the screen. She had tried not to listen either, but that was impossible. It was some kind of taped interview. A man and a very frightened woman. The man talked like a psychiatrist, maintaining an even and professional tone as the woman's story unfolded like a nightmare, a tale of torture and a phallic knife that ended each night with the same horrible crescendo. What happened next?
He yanked the knife from my mouth, very fast, cut like a razor.
What then?
He asked me, "Do you like the knife?"
Did you answer?
No. So he shouted again, "Do you like the knife?"
Did you answer this time?
I just shook my head. And then he shouted again, "Say it loud. Say you don't like the knife." So I did. I shouted back. Over and over he made me shout it, "I don't like the knife."
Then what?
He whispered into my ear.
What did he say?
"Next time, be glad it's not the knife."
Beth cringed beneath the blanket. Experience had taught her that the end of the tape only triggered the worst part, the self-indulgent groaning, the climax and release. Tonight, as on past nights, those sounds filled the room, deep and guttural. She didn't have to peer out from beneath the sheets to know what was going on. The unmistakable noises sent her imagination racing as to the perverse mind in the chair beside her. One thing, however, her ears were sure of. The intruder was a man. The television blackened. The chair squeaked. His boots shuffled across the floor. The door opened and closed behind him. The lock clicked from the outside. Again, she was alone, in total darkness. Andy hardly slept that night. She lay awake troubled by the ease with which Bleckman had detected things as personal as her adoption and broken engagement. Was it possible he did have some kind of gift? She had heard of people like that, though it seemed just as likely that he had been toying with her, somehow knowing all along she was an undercover agent. Then again, virtually all of his followers were recovering from failed relationships and family trouble of some kind. An experienced palm reader might have done as well as he had. At 5 a.m., there was a knock on the door. Felicia answered it without a word, as though she had been expecting it. A man entered. Andy's eyes slowly focused. It wasn't Bleckman. It was Tom, the other lieutenant who had spoken with Felicia at Tuesday night's recruitment meeting, the man whose voice imprint had been identical to hers. "Let's go, Willow." It took Andy a moment to realize he was talking to her. Andy, a.k.a. Kira, was now Willow. "Where are we going?" "Put your clothes on and let's go." He was wearing only a nightshirt and skimpy running shorts. Tom caught an eyeful on her way to the bathroom. It was a lecherous glare. Something to be expected from one of those 50-year-old loners who got kissed once a decade and cruised in a van with a bumper sticker that read, "If it's a rockin', don't come knockin'." You could use a little work on losing earthly desires, bucko. They were out the door in 5 minutes. Felicia stayed behind. Sunrise was more than an hour away. The ground was damp from patchy fog. Their boots made a swooshing sound as they walked through the coarse, ankle-high grass. Tom stopped and lit up a cigarette as they reached a safe distance from the house. "They allow smoking here?" asked Andy. "You got a problem with it?" "It just seems like it would be one of those forbidden self-indulgences." "Rule number one, Willow. Thou shalt not judge thy superiors." Interesting, thought Andy. A smoker. A peeping Tom. Literally. Yet his voice imprint had been virtually identical to Felicia's. Either he was a believer with some weaknesses or a non-believer with incredible acting skills. Either way, Andy wanted to explore. They continued over a hill toward the chicken coop, where they were greeted by the ammonia-laden odor of fowl excrement and the incessant chirping of hundreds of week-old chicks. Like ants, they climbed over each other at various feeders and waterers spaced evenly throughout the coop. Little yellow fuzzy balls, wall-to-wall cuteness. It made Andy think of Easter, till she looked more closely. A few lay dead on the ground. The weak stumbled about, too timid to make a serious charge toward the source of nourishment.
Pick up the dead ones, said Tom. Put them in the bucket. Andy took the bucket and entered the coop, careful not to crush the live ones. With each step, she sent clusters of chicks scattering. Every few feet, she found a dead one. She felt a mixture of pity and disgust, especially for the eviscerated ones that had been cannibalized by their sisters. Each carcass weighed practically nothing, but soon her bucket was heavy. She finished in a few minutes and returned to Tom. He took the bucket and handed her another. Now get the weak ones.
In a bucket?
Yeah, like this. He grabbed a chick that was stumbling around the fringe. It chirped pathetically in his hand. With one quick jerk, he silenced it, then tossed it in the bucket. Andy had seen much worse in her career, but Tom seemed to expect some revulsion from Willow. He somehow seemed to think he was impressing her. She played along. I can't kill an innocent little chick.
Yeah, you can.
But I don't want to.
It's your job, Willow.
But you do it so well.
And with a little practice, you'll be every bit as good. He winked.
It wasn't easy to flirt with an obvious loser like Tom, but it seemed like a way to open the door. I would think picking up chicks comes pretty naturally to a guy like you.
That was my other life, he said with a smile.
Quite the heartbreaker, were you?
I had my fair share.
And now you're celibate?
He quickly deflated. Felicia'll talk to you about that.
I just assumed that was part of the deal. All this talk about weaning oneself of earthly desires. Sex has to be right up there with cable TV and ice cream.
He was obviously uncomfortable. Andy said,
Am I making you nervous?
Just men and women aren't supposed to have this discussion. Felicia will talk to you.
I'm sorry. Somehow I just felt at ease talking to you.
That seemed to please him.
Really?
Yeah.
You know how you just get a good feeling about a person?
Yeah.
But hey, if you're uncomfortable, let's just go back to killing baby chickens.
No, I wasn't rejecting you.
I hope not, said Andy. It'd be nice to have a friend.
I don't think there's anything in the rules against that.
She glanced at his cigarette. Not that the rules are written in stone.
Smoking is a minor infraction, he said defensively. More serious stuff can get you kicked out.
Like what?
Like sex.
Why is that so bad?
Because it not only depletes your energy, but it takes you further away from the source. That's the whole problem with satisfying your worldly urges.
So this entire belief system is based on abstinence?
No, it's based on fulfillment. But it comes in ways you've never experienced before.
If it's so fulfilling, why do you still enjoy things like smoking?
Because I'm still human. To be honest with you, I don't really enjoy smoking all that much. I just do it. That's the way it is with everything that binds us to this world. That's the cornerstone of Mr. Bleckman's philosophy. He teaches us that our emotions, our impulses, our desires are like an echo.
An echo?
Yeah. Any experience is most intense and gratifying the first time. Each subsequent experience is mere repetition, growing weaker and weaker, like an echo, until we are totally disconnected from the source of energy that inspired us to try something new in the first place.
I don't want you to think I have a one-track mind, but I wouldn't say the best sex I ever had was the first time I had it.
Get beyond sex, will you please? Think of the first time you saw the ocean, the first time you rode a bicycle, the first time you flew on an airplane,
the first time you killed?
He was taken aback.
Like a baby chick, I mean, said Andy.
That works, too. Anything that makes you feel a rush of energy and changes your level of vibration. After a while, we simply become numb to it. But we keep doing it, hoping we can get some glimpse of the thrill we experienced the first time.
You get a thrill from killing?
I didn't say thrill.
I'm sorry, I thought you did. He was nervous again, drawing on his cigarette, though it had burned to the filter.
All I'm saying is that we shouldn't be wasting our energy through repetition. We should be redirecting our energy.
Toward the source, said Andy.
Yes.
He crushed out his cigarette.
But you and I shouldn't be having this discussion. I'm getting way ahead of your program. You know a lot more than someone is supposed to know at your level.
Much more, she thought.
A band of clouds broke on the horizon. Golden rays of morning light pierced the coop's slatted walls. As Tom glanced toward the rising sun, Andy studied his profile. She couldn't quite place it, but he looked strangely familiar. He caught her staring, and she quickly looked away. Andy picked up her bucket and returned to her task, watching out of the corner of her eye, as Tom methodically moved about the flock and culled out the weak.
Chapter 58. It wasn't yet sunrise, and Gus was in Beth's side of their master bedroom closet. Ever since he'd uncovered the fruits of her shoplifting, he'd wondered what other clues to Beth's whereabouts might be hiding in there. Over the past 2 weeks, he'd examined jewelry, photographs, memorabilia, and thousands of other little things that had found their way into the drawers and boxes that lined the walls of their oversized closet. Having sifted through some items for the third or fourth time, he realized this was becoming less a hunt for clues than a way to reconnect with Beth. It was his sanity in another sleepless night. Tonight he had more focus. Something about that letter from Martha Goldstein yesterday had gnawed at his memory. It was more the paper itself than the message she had written on it. The unusually high linen content of her personal stationery lent the distinctive fuchsia blend a marble-like appearance. Somewhere he had seen it before. It had taken several hours of lying awake in bed to realize where. Beth had kept a junk drawer of things related to his law firm. He had blown past it quickly in nights past, figuring it couldn't possibly contain anything important. As he thumbed through the drawer this time, however, his opinion quickly changed. Tucked behind some old programs from past firm banquets was a fuchsia envelope. The postmark told him it was more than a year old. Neither the envelope nor the stationery inside bore a return address. It had been written anonymously, on one of those blank extra sheets that come with each box of personal engraved stationery. It was an unsigned letter to Beth, penned in the same handwriting and on the same fuchsia stationery Gus had seen yesterday in the letter from Martha Goldstein. He read eagerly, his anger rising in the second paragraph. "It doesn't matter who I am," she had written. "What's important is that your husband has given himself to me, and it's time you faced the truth." He stopped, stunned. She had chosen her words carefully, given himself. It was consistent with Martha's view of them as soulmates. Yet the implication, the intended message to Beth, was that Gus was having sex with another woman. The whole deceptive package was classic Martha. The letter was unsigned, which meant Beth would have had to confront Gus if she had wanted to know who had written it. It was written in her own script so that Gus would know it was Martha. Forcing him to tell his wife that the anonymous author was Martha would only make the letter more believable to Beth. Somehow Beth had figured out it was Martha on her own, since she'd filed the letter away in the drawer of law firm-related junk. Beth had never said a word to Gus. She'd internalized it, which went a long way to explain her paranoia about him and Martha. A noise stirred him. In the pre-dawn darkness, the wind whistled through branches outside the bedroom window. The clock ticked in the hallway. All else was still. He thought immediately of Dex's warning that someone had followed him to the Red Lion Hotel last night. He stepped quietly from the closet and checked the alarm panel on the wall. It was armed, no sign of intrusion. He left the bedroom and peered down the hall. Again, only silence. He walked slowly to the front door and peeked through the beveled glass. The car was still in the driveway. No one scurried across the lawn. He headed for the kitchen. The wind was kicking up outside, but the branches against the house didn't sound at all like the noise that had roused him from sleep. He switched on the kitchen light and started. The rubber trash can had been pulled out from under the sink and left near the dishwasher, not its usual place. It was upright but bulging, nearly overflowing. Something that resembled a tail was curling out from under the lid. Gus stepped closer and checked inside. It was Garfield. One of Morgan's big stuffed animals was in the garbage. He pulled it out. Tigger was in there, too, along with a fuzzy cub from the Lion King collection. Two more stuffed felines and a ceramic Sylvester. They weren't ripped, stained, or particularly worn out. They had just been summarily discarded. He hurried to Morgan's room. The door was open and her light was on. "Morgan," he said with urgency. Her head popped from beneath the covers.
"I can't sleep."
"What's wrong?"
"Nothing."
"Does this have anything to do with what I found in the garbage can?"
"You didn't take them out, did you?"
"Yes."
"Daddy, no. Put them back."
"Why are you throwing them away?"
"Because."
He recalled their earlier conversation in the car about getting a cat. "Morgan, your mom is allergic to real cats, not stuffed animals."
"I know. But if I keep all these fake cats around, I might forget."
With soulful eyes, he came to her and sat on the edge of the bed. "Sweetheart, you will never forget your mommy."
"I don't want to forget anything about her, even little things. Like, I don't want to forget she's allergic to cats."
"Don't worry about that, okay? I'm going to do everything possible to bring mommy home. And then you won't ever, ever have to worry about forgetting anything." She was silent for a moment, then quizzical.
"Have you forgotten things about mommy?"
He wasn't sure how to answer. He settled for the truth. "It's funny, but since your mother disappeared, I actually remember more about her."
"That's a good thing, I guess. You can get back the things you forget. If you really strain your brain?"
"Not so much the brain, sweetheart."
"Which part?"
He held her close. "A part I haven't used in a very long time." After breakfast, Felicia drove Andy into town in the old station wagon. In the back seat was a woman at Felicia's supervisory level and a 19-year-old girl who was in her second month of training. Tom and his young male recruit drove separately in an SUV. Monday morning was when the cult purchased groceries and essentials that couldn't be produced on the farm. It was viewed as grunt work, reserved for the newest members, under the strict supervision of their mentors, of course. They stopped at a big price-cutting warehouse that sold everything from radial tires to cinnamon rolls, mostly in army-like quantities. Andy had been to a similar place in Seattle, with the bare cement floors and huge pallets of Twinkies and paper towels stacked 60 feet to the ceiling. She felt like a Lilliputian. They broke into teams of two, each recruit with a mentor. Each team had a list of things to retrieve from different parts of the warehouse. They were to buy only what was on the list. Salt, flour and raw sugar, soap, toilet paper, matches and batteries. Basic medications such as aspirin and rubbing alcohol. All of the things Bleckman regarded as necessities. Andy pushed the shopping cart as Felicia retrieved items from the shelves. They talked very little. Andy couldn't stop thinking about the echoes concept. Her bookend theory had been out the window for some time, but echoes seemed apt. Two men and three women had been murdered in echo-like fashion. Her discovery made her restless and eager to brainstorm. Isaac had given her until Wednesday to check in, but she wasn't sure when she might get away from the farm again. She had to seize the opportunity. "Felicia, I'm going to use the bathroom, all right?" "Okay, I'll be right here." The restrooms were in the rear of the store, near the butcher department, behind a pair of swinging doors and at the end of a long corridor. Andy hoped there would be a payphone nearby. There was. She quickly dialed Isaac's private number.
Isaac, it's Andy.
Are you okay?
I'm fine. I can't talk long.
She feared Felicia would burst through the doors any second. In 2 minutes, she summarized her weekend, focusing mainly on the echoes. Isaac said, "Of course, even if this philosophy spawned the murders, it doesn't mean Bleckman is our serial killer."
I wondered what your take would be.
It could be one of his demented followers. It might even be some psycho who read or heard about his teachings and is simply mocking the echo idea. After all, his seminars are open to the public. Who knows what kind of demented ideas people get?
That's what I want to find out.
With a nervous glance, she checked the hall, thinking she heard footsteps. Andy, you've done a good job. But for your own safety, I think it's time we pull you out and just move in.
But I haven't seen a single sign of Beth Wheatley yet. I couldn't even tell you if she's here.
Then maybe she isn't.
But if she is, she could be dead the minute the FBI starts knocking on the door.
We might consider a more aggressive takeover, take them by surprise.
That's a terrible idea, and you know it.
Remember Waco? You've been inside. You think there's a potential for mass suicide?
I don't know. But think of what you said earlier. What if the killer is just someone who might have passed through the cult and is no longer here? The FBI will want the cult's cooperation in identifying people who came to their meetings. Invading their compound is not going to endear them to the FBI and make them want to cooperate.
Isaac was silent. Andy checked the doors again at the end of the corridor. Through the little diamond-shaped window, she could see Felicia coming down the aisle. This was taking too long.
Just give me 48 hours, and give it to me now before they catch me on the phone.
He was thinking. Andy's heart pounded as Felicia neared the doors.
Isaac, please!
All right, you got it.
Thank you, gotta go.
She slammed down the phone and started walking toward the doors just as they swung open.
There you are, said Felicia.
Chapter 59. Beth lay alone in the darkness. It was a helpless feeling, but she had learned not to pound on the walls or scream for help. That kind of behavior would only get her handcuffed and gagged. One night she had carried on so long, he had revoked her lights-on privileges. 2 days of total darkness, including meals and bathroom breaks. She guessed it was 2 days, based on the number of meals she had eaten. With no clock or windows, there was no way to be sure. Good behavior did seem to have its rewards. The lights used to come on only during meal and bathroom break. Now she seemed to get a grace period before and after. Once she had even been allowed outdoors to work at the chicken coop, albeit not without the electronic belt locked around her torso. It worked like those invisible fences for dogs, only this one would hit her like a stun gun if she got too close to the electrified boundaries. It had been good to get outdoors, though the farm had been strangely deserted that day. Almost everyone was away, perhaps on retreat. Beth knew about retreats. It was how she had gotten caught up in the first place. In hindsight, it was easy to understand the initial appeal of Bleckman's philosophy. She had been tired of wasting her energy trying to put the magic back in her marriage. It was like an echo, intense at first, then fading over time. It was as if each anniversary were just another hollow ring in the distance, each one a little weaker and farther from the source, until it was completely inaudible, nothing left. The idea of redirecting her energy and changing her level of vibration had been a revelation. She was revitalized for a time that included many a day-long visit to the farm when Gus was out of town. On the positive side, they had helped her identify and talk out her anxieties. Ultimately, however, she and her mentors came to a bitter disagreement over the root cause. They saw it as a huge problem, but she didn't see it as a problem at all. She still loved Gus. The way they wanted Beth to handle that problem was something she could never bring herself to do. The result was solitary confinement. She wasn't getting much direction from the leaders, but she assumed the idea was to isolate her from worldly influences until she channeled her energy properly. All of this time alone, however, had only separated her further from their way of thinking. With no one to talk to, she conjured up pleasant images from her past. Morgan was a frequent subject.
There was quite a lot of Gus in the way they used to be. Had they read her mind, her mentors would have been furious. Today, her thoughts were not so pleasant. Almost against her own will, certain sounds were replaying in her mind. They revolved around the nightly ritual she had come to dread so much. She blocked out the ones that frightened her, the woman on tape, the sounds of his enjoyment. Instead, she focused on things that confused her, in particular, the sounds of his leaving. In her mind, she could hear him rise from the chair and switch off the television, hear him cross the room and open the door shutting and locking from the outside. Those were the sounds she had heard every night. Last night, however, something had been missing. There had been a break in the routine. She didn't hear that familiar hydraulic sound of the VCR ejecting the videotape. She focused harder, this time on his arrival. Come to think of it, she hadn't heard him insert the videotape either. And it wasn't just last night. It had happened on the last several nights, at least. That explained the mechanical whining upon his arrival, the sounds of the tape rewinding. For some reason, he had been leaving the tape in the VCR. It could have been an oversight on his part, but that was unlikely. Very little happened on the farm without a purpose. If he was leaving the tape in the VCR, it was for a reason, and there was only one she could imagine. He wanted her to watch it. The prospect didn't seem as frightening without him in the room. She had heard it so many times, seeing it couldn't be that disturbing. Slowly, she slid from the bed and stepped onto the floor. The room was black, but she knew the way from memory. She took small steps, almost sliding her feet across the room. She groped with her hands in front of her until she felt something. It was the television screen. She poked and probed until she found the on-off switch and hit it. The screen lit up with snow. She quickly muted the volume so that no one in the hall could hear. The set wasn't hooked up to a cable or antenna, of course. It was a good source of light, but up until now she had been afraid to use it for fear of breaking the rules. Curiosity, however, had emboldened her. It wasn't so much that she wanted to see the tape. She wanted to know why he wanted her to see it. She hit the rewind button and waited as the tape whined to the beginning. It took only a minute. Then she hit play and stepped back. She stared at the screen as the image appeared. A woman was seated on a chair, facing the camera. She seemed nervous, but it wasn't her demeanor that struck Beth. "My name is Alicia Santiago," she said. Beth shut it off, her hand shaking. 10 seconds into the video, and she had seen enough. The woman was gone, but the television screen was glowing with a dark blue background. It enabled Beth to see her reflection in the glass. She hadn't seen her likeness since her arrival. She brought a hand to her face and felt the contours of her cheeks, the curve of her mouth. She touched her hair, the short, dark hair. It was obvious now why they had cut it. The resemblance was chilling. Beth looked almost exactly like the woman in the video. She switched off the television and returned to darkness. Chapter 60. Monday was slipping away, and Gus had yet to hear from Meredith. He had the money for Bleckman's manuscript, $25,000. He found it hard to believe she would just walk away from that much cash. She had warned him not to call, but he was beginning to worry. From his home office, he dialed her number. No answer. That could mean any number of things, none of them good. Again, he picked up the phone and hit the speed dial. "Carla, it's Gus. Can you come over and watch Morgan? I need to go out for a while." Andy was alone in her unit when she heard a knock on the door. Felicia had gone to some kind of meeting. It was Tom, and he looked angry. "We need to talk, Willow." She felt threatened by his tone. "Okay," she said, but she didn't invite him in. "Inside." "Is there a problem?" "You know what the problem is." He quickly had her by the arm, led her inside, and nearly pushed her on the bed. "What are you doing?" she asked. He was pacing, getting more worked up. "You got Felicia in one hell of a lot of trouble, you know that?
Steve is giving her what for right now.
What are you talking about?
Don't deny it, he snapped. Deny what? That phone call you made from the grocery warehouse. You were being watched.
Watched was okay. It was listening that Andy worried about.
So, they heard? We don't have to hear. We know you weren't calling for the time and weather. Who was it? Your mother again?
She struggled to contain her relief. She lowered her head.
Yes, she peeped as if ashamed. I promised Mom I would call home the first chance I got. I knew it. I just didn't want her to worry.
She flashed a repentant, sultry look. It worked. He stopped pacing. His voice lost its edge.
Darn it, Willow. You have to stop worrying about people and things you've left behind.
I've only been here a few days. You can't expect miracles.
A clean break is the only way. If you try to wean yourself a little at a time, you'll never make it.
Is that how you did it?
That's how we all did it.
Didn't you miss some things?
Yeah. My pickup truck.
You had to give up your truck?
That was my contribution when I joined the group. We all make contributions to keep the cause financed. One woman gave over her house.
I wish I had something to contribute.
That's not important. Right now, all that matters is that you follow the rules. Phoning your mother, well, that's a lot worse than sneaking a cigarette now and then.
He cracked a faint smile to make her feel better. She returned the smile, then turned serious.
Can I ask you something?
Sure.
I've been wondering about something for a while. That talk we had this morning only made me more curious.
What is it?
It just seems... I hear a lot of talk about sacrifice and giving up earthly desires. The purpose is to get to the next level, right?
Right.
So let's say I do everything right. I stop calling my mother. I let go of all the selfish inclinations that make me so human. I do all the things I'm supposed to do. What happens next? How do I get from this level to the next?
He looked away, hedging.
That's really getting way ahead of your program.
But maybe it would help me be more disciplined if I knew. Those things you told me this morning about the echoes were ahead of schedule, and they really helped me.
I really can't discuss the transformation with you.
There must be something you can tell me.
Is it like traditional Judeo-Christian beliefs, where they say you have to die before you can go to heaven? No, it's not like that at all.
So the transformation comes when you're alive?
Yes.
He hesitated, but then seemed compelled to explain.
But we're not like many of the ufologists who believe that you must be fully conscious.
I don't understand.
You've heard of these groups who believe that a UFO will come down and take those who are ready to the next level? They believe you must be fully conscious to make that journey.
Blackman has said all along he's not a ufologist. So what is he?
I can't explain everything to you, but trust me. It makes so much sense.
It makes no sense. If he doesn't believe you have to die, but he doesn't believe you have to be conscious, what is he saying? You need to be in a coma?
He became deadly serious, as if offended by her remark. He's saying there is a window of opportunity between life and death. You've heard of people who were near death and who claimed their whole life passed before their eyes?
Sure.
These flashbacks are the echoes that Stephen talks about. Your entire life echoes before you, and in this one lucid moment you understand where you have come from and where you're going. Now, you've also heard people say they have passed over to the other side and seen a white light or were embraced by the light?
Yes.
Those people are going nowhere, Willow. If they don't see the echoes, they have no understanding. They don't reach the next level.
Things were starting to make sense to her, specifically the hangings.
Is it the same window of opportunity no matter how you die? Or is it beneficial to linger for a time between life and death? That's something I can't talk about.
She nodded, backing off.
I understand. This was helpful, thank you. You're welcome.
I need to get back to the house, check on Felicia. As he started for the door, she gave him one more of those disarming smiles.
Hey, Tom.
Yeah? Just out of curiosity, what kind of pickup truck did you used to have?
Ford. Hated to lose it, but hell, it's not important.
Good night. Good night, he said, closing the door behind him. She remained seated on the bed, thinking. Maybe the truck wasn't important to him, but it was to her. The physical resemblance was part of it. His brown eyes and graying hair. But it was the personal data that had triggered the recognition. The little things she had put together from conversations with him and others. He was divorced, early 50s. He had even driven the same vehicle, a Ford pickup. Tom was a match for the serial killer's two male victims. Chapter 61. Gus reached the Borge residence in under an hour. Dex followed separately and parked a short distance up the road, out of sight in the darkness. If Meredith was home, it was important that Gus appear to be alone. If something was amiss, alone was the last thing he actually wanted to be. Her car was parked in the driveway, but the porch light was not burning. No lights were on inside either, as far as Gus could tell. The house was completely dark. He walked up the front steps, rang the doorbell, and waited. No one answered. In fact, he didn't even hear the bell ring. He knocked, but still no one came. He cupped his hands to the oval window in the front door and peered inside. It was too dark to see past the foyer. He backed away from the door, thinking he had heard an approaching car. The gravel road was deserted. A door slammed, and he realized it had come from a neighbor's house on the next road over. Sounds traveled well in this rural area, just one or two houses on each long and curving, unpaved street. He signaled up the road to Dex, who was watching from a distance through night vision binoculars. Gus climbed down the front steps and continued around to the back of the house. It was even darker in back than in front, farther from the streetlight. A rattling from the trash cans sent his heart leaping to his throat. A hungry raccoon scurried away. In the return to silence, he gathered his wits. Once again, all was quiet. Certainly quiet enough for his knocking to have been heard. If she was home. If she could still hear. He sidestepped the spilled trash and checked the back door. He was about to knock, then stopped. One of the small rectangles of glass was shattered, the one right above the door lock. It looked as though someone had forced their way inside. His instincts said run, but his feet wouldn't move. Meredith? He called out. His voice sounded hollow even to him. There was no reply. He tried again, louder. Meredith Borge! Dex came quickly from the other side of the garage, his voice filled with urgency. Electricity's been cut. Call 911. The door flew open as Gus reached for his cell phone. It was an explosion without explosives, like horses out of a gate. The door and whoever was behind it sent him tumbling backward down the stairs. He was suddenly wrestling on the lawn with a man in a sleek black bodysuit. Freeze! Shouted Dex, his gun drawn. A gunshot pierced the night. Dex went down. Falling, he fired off several return rounds. The attacker fired back as he raced across the yard and leaped over the fence. Gus hurried to Dex, who had been hit in the shoulder and was writhing in pain.
Did I hit him?
Asked Dex.
I don't think so. Damn! Who the hell was that?
Sure wasn't Meredith. Are you going to be okay?
I will be, he answered, groaning. But my shoulder's DOA. Call 911 already.
The phone had landed just a few feet away in the scuffle. Gus grabbed it and dialed.
Yes, operator, there's been a shooting at the Borge residence on Rural Route 67.
Is there a better address?
That's the best I can do.
Someone was shot with a gun, you say?
Yes, a man.
Is he alive?
Yes, it's a shoulder wound.
Was anyone else hurt?
He glanced at the house, thinking of Meredith.
Quite possibly. Exactly how many people have been injured, sir?
I don't know. One, for sure. For God's sake, are you coming or not?
I'll dispatch police and paramedics right away.
Thank you. Hurry. He hung up and dialed home. His sister answered. Carla, is everything okay there?
Yeah, everything's fine.
Something terrible has happened.
What?
Just... That's not important. I want you to grab Morgan right now. Both of you get in the car and drive to the police station as fast as you can.
Gus, what's going on?
Just do it.
All right, all right.
I'll meet you there as soon as the paramedics arrive.
Paramedics? Gus,
get going, Carla.
Okay, I'm leaving right this second.
I hope that's soon enough, he thought, but he didn't dare say it. Across the lawn, Dex lay languidly across the sidewalk, his shoulder bathed in blood. Gus went to him and draped his coat over his body to keep the chill off and prevent shock.
One more call,
Dex said weakly.
What are you talking about?
It's time you told the FBI about that note on your windshield. The warning in Beth's handwriting suddenly blazed in his mind. Stay away from Meredith Borge, or I end up like her daughter. That it had been signed Flora, however, still complicated matters. Dex grabbed him with newfound strength.
You have to call him. Even if it does make it look like Beth might really be part of that cult.
Gus grabbed Dex's gun.
First, I have to check on Meredith. You're not going in that house. I have to check on her. It could take 10 minutes for the cops to get out here in the sticks. If she's hanging by her neck, another minute could make all the difference. If there's another guy with a gun in there, you're both dead. Don't risk your life to save that woman. That woman might know where my wife is. Face it, man. Your wife joined a cult. Shut the hell up, or I'll shoot you in the other shoulder. Fine, be a hero. I just hope to hell she's alone.
And alive, said Gus, as he started toward the house.
This ends Disc 10, Under Cover of Darkness, Disc 11.
Chapter 62. Andy hadn't moved from the bed. In her mind, she was sorting through the talk with Tom, trying to reconcile the cult's philosophy with the physical evidence in the serial killings. Two dead men both resembled Tom. Three dead women all resembled Beth. A cult premised on the notion that all worldly experience was like an echo, and that transformation to the next level came about only during that window of opportunity between life and death. A window that was wide open while hanging by the neck. If it was all that simple, then why wasn't Beth Wheatley on the farm? Or if she was there, why was she nowhere to be seen? Andy tried to sleep but couldn't close her eyes, too many questions pounding inside her head. Beth's room was black when the music started. She had no control over it, no more than she controlled the room temperature or anything else in her environment. Over the past 2 weeks, various classical pieces had played over two large speakers in the ceiling, coming and going at different times of the day for no apparent reason. At first, she had thought it was a reward of some kind. Lately, it seemed more like a way to keep her from hearing what was going on outside her room. It seemed so long ago that she had dropped Morgan off at the youth center, driven to meet Carla for a Sunday lunch, and parked her car in the garage. It had all